Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Danny Sersin knows the cost of war. He served as an Army officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. And since then, after teaching history at West Point, he has been writing prolifically, exhibiting critical thinking, and I really value his voice. You're going to hear a powerful personal story about how his service in the military led to his skepticism of the modern use of the military. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. Great people like Suzanne Bowen, Aidan McAleer, the ever-generous Faith Peoples, and Susan Gavet. Will you join them? Visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber, you hit the sign-up page, and I think you can take it from there. Danny Sersin, the skeptical soldier, returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today.
Take me to a war party. Me and I wanna go. Everybody seems to be inviting me to a war party. Me and I wanna go. Heard about the last one, so thanks, but no thank you.
Heard about the last one? So thanks, but no thanks. Eddie Grant warms up the podcast today. That's called War Party. Danny Sersin has served in our military, taught at West Point, and he has forged a new identity as a writer of great talent and a man who comments on some of the most important issues of the day. Danny, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always glad to do it.
Well, I really respect your voice, and people certainly have responded to the podcast we did earlier this year. And I try desperately to keep up with your publication, but based on recent surveys, you publish a column more often than the average American guy changes his underwear.
You know, that might almost be true. In fact, some of my original editors, specifically Tom from Tom Dispatch, have told me that I should really slow down because people can't consume what I'm writing. But, you know, writing is catharsis for me, and it just so much happens that I feel the need or the duty to comment on that. It's just, you know, next thing you know, it's 2 to 4 articles a week.
Yeah. Well, you are guilty of critical thinking, and I want you to continue. It really makes a difference, and every time I see a new column from you, I read it with interest. Before we dive into some of your recent publication, you and I are speaking on the late in the morning of Thursday, September 26th, and the acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, has just wound up some testimony before the House Intelligence Committee. And this is part of this emerging scandal regarding President Trump's apparent efforts to squeeze the new president of Ukraine to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden's activities in Ukraine back during the Poroshenko administration there. Without trying to poison you with my own thoughts, what are yours about this? Do you think that this is a credible path to impeachment? Do you think that it is the simple case of criminal behavior by the president that the Democrats claim will make impeachment more possible?
You know, I have some provocative thoughts on impeachment coming from the left, as I tend to do. I thought Russiagate was a fraud. I didn't think there was any there when it came to actual collusion. I think this matter about Ukraine and the Bidens is serious, and it may well reach the threshold of misdemeanors or high crimes. If I got those backwards, but I think impeachment is a terrible idea. I think it's the wrong path. I think Trump needs to be defeated at the ballot box, and he needs to be defeated handily, so he'll actually leave power. Scarily, I think that that's necessary. His people will not abandon him. You know, he accurately said that, you know, he could shoot someone in Fifth Avenue, of course, and they wouldn't leave him behind. I think this makes the Democrats look desperate. I think it's an end run to trying to defeat Trump. It bothers me because it's futile in the first place. I mean, they're not going to remove this president in the Senate. They need 67 votes, and the Republicans have, what, 52 or 53 senators, and it's just not going to happen. I mean, this is the era of Mitch McConnell. I mean, this is the McConnell era. He's not going to allow his people to remove Trump. And so what I fear is they're going to throw all their eggs in this basket, distract attention from the real issues that should be getting talked about, at least in the primary debates that are ongoing and exhausting. And if anything, they're going to hand a second term to Trump. And the other thing that gets me is this is bad, right? This scandal is serious, but it's no more serious than a whole bunch of other things Trump has done before that are potentially worse. You know, support for Yemen. Of course, Obama did that too, the war in Yemen, the border policy. I mean, thing after thing, the overreach of executive power that not only Trump, but the whole system is capable of. So, you know, I just finished a piece today, you know, that I cranked out, you know, in lieu of what's going on. And I called it, you know, you guys can read it at Truth Dig in the next few days. It's called, you know, Impeach the System, Not Trump. So that's kind of my thoughts on the whole process.
Well, Danny, you and I are in full agreement that Russiagate was a boondoggle. And fundamentally, the initial claim was never proven that Russia hacked the DNC. Mueller gave a limited hangout investigation that I found predictable. So we fully agree there. I do have a different view of overall impeachment. I think that the Democrats have a duty to make a record of the lawlessness of this president and his brazen efforts to expand presidential power in breathtaking ways. That said, I believe that this Ukraine case is going to blow up on them. I think that they I used the term premature ejaculation when I described it yesterday, you know, without enough information from the whistleblower complaint, we got what passes for a transcript that does have ellipses in it. If you read the transcript, it does not amount to the 30-minute phone conversation that we were told that the two presidents engaged in. So there are many issues related to the so-called evidence in this case. And I agree with you that Trump has abused his power, that this is an effort to get a foreign government to, in some way, influence the election in the United States. And at the same time, I am appalled at the media malpractice as we see organ after organ say flatly that there is nothing to allegations of wrongdoing by Joe and Hunter Biden. And fundamentally, the U.S.-backed coup that took down Yanukovych, that installed Poroshenko, that led to Burisma Holdings to say, gosh, who should we have on our board? And Hunter Biden, the do-nothing son of the vice president, suddenly gets this $50,000 a month perch. And, of course, Hunter Biden's previous episode of nepotism was that daddy got him a job on the Amtrak board. I think he served there for 3 or 4 years. So this is tawdry. It pales in comparison to the brazen corruption and, you know, patronage and other activities that Trump has engaged in with his children and surrounded by his cronies. But I think that, number one, this investigation is going to remove Joe Biden from the Democratic primary. I'm not personally upset about that, but I think that it's a consequence of the Democrats' rush into this Ukraine flap. And I feel that there are much better bases, as you do, for disciplining this president. And while I'm not, game to just let the 2020 election determine whether he gets a second term, I'm also not interested in using underhanded tactics to try to create a trap in order to remove this president. So that's a long-winded response to your comment.
I think you make some good points, especially about the need to record, record some of this, wild corruption. This is a guy who has no doubt run our country, as some sort of combination between a nepotistic mafia family and a corrupt Atlantic City casino, right? Which is all appropriate given his background. I worry about a lot of things regarding this, and I think you're right that this actually could knock Biden out of the race, because that phone call between the two presidents, I agree, sort of does pale in comparison to, the scandal of America meddling in Ukraine and sort of creating this crisis, or at least helping create the crisis with Russia and the violence that followed, and of course the nepotism of Hunter Biden and his kind of role dealing with this, corrupt government in Ukraine. I mean, the whole thing stinks, and it's not as black and white as the Democrats are going to make it out to be. They're going to try to use it as like the anvil to crush Trump on, but I think you're right that it's going to blow up in their face, because they're going to try to do this absent all the context that you pointed out, and that never ends particularly well.
And McGuire is a tool. He's caught between this autocratic president who's trying to control him and his desire probably to hold on to the gig, hold on to some semblance of his reputation. And he got caught between the maneuvering, with the Justice Department saying this doesn't quite meet the criteria of a whistleblower. And there's some merit to that. I just believe that this will be a convoluted process where there will be no clear winner. And it's kind of like a pissing contest where, both people end up stinky and wet.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
All right. Danny, let's turn now to a powerful and personal piece that you wrote for TomDispatch.com, and it's been circulated pretty widely at other outlets since you posted it on September 22nd. And this is a personal account of your odyssey from a proud American patriot who wanted to do something about 9/11 to someone whose skepticism led to, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but a form of functional disillusionment, accented by your personal issues with PTSD and inner struggle that you took on to deal with your experiences in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I want to begin by crediting Tom Engelhart, your editor at Tom Dispatch, because it's clear that he is able to get writers like you and Colonel Andrew Basevich to go beyond your policy analysis and put it in very personal terms. And that's what I felt as I read this impactful piece.
Well, Tom most certainly does that. He really pushes us to throw our personal story out there, even when our instinct is to kind of, focus on our academic credentials or our expertise and keep ourselves in the background. But I've gotten more comfortable with it. Tom's really an interesting guy, and his site, TomDispatch.com, is just a must read. He's really the only guy out there, or one of the few guys out there, who's publishing 2,500 and 3,000 word long form pieces anymore. Everyone else I write for is like yells at me if I'm over 1,000 words, and I got to beg for an extra 100. So he does a lot of interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
This story is a personal one. I've told other personal stories, but never in this, broad and almost comprehensive history of my life since I graduated from West Point in May of 2005 through really today. And it is a story of gradual disillusionment. It's a lonely story, because being an apostate military atheist who still lives in the military monastery is a lonely place.
Yeah.
You lose friends. You get cautioned by mentors. You lose your career ultimately. You know, I was lucky enough to have it both ways, in the sense that I received a medical retirement and a modest pension. A lot of people who dissent get a lot worse. But I was under investigation legally and had to stop writing for 4 months about a year and a half ago. And, you know, they threatened to take my pension and, you know, just discipline me on the way out. And luckily I was exonerated of sorts, or, you know, they decided not to do that. But it's been a tough life. And, you know, for me, it's been, and I think the story I wrote tells this, a combination of personal experience, which brought disillusionment, but then also picking up the books. You know, I hit the books once I realized the war in Iraq was wrong and that I had been wrong about it. Then I said, well, if I was wrong about this, what else was I wrong about? And that was it, man. You know, give me an Amazon account and a library card, and I'm the most dangerous soldier in America. You know, and that's what I did. I hit the books, and I found out that the whole system was not what I thought it was. And that's really the story I tried to tell.
And, Danny, you know, central to this is a commitment to critical thinking. And as we look at so many people in the current context, the Republicans on Capitol Hill, former Admiral McGuire, who, as I said, is a tool who is caught in the machinery here as it clashes. But people have given up their independent thought, their commitment to principle, to being able to say, no, that is wrong, or wait a minute, that's not why you said we were going into Iraq. That is not the mission that was laid out for us. And so, you know, in various ways, as a nation, I believe that we have devalued critical thinking and simply, you know, embraced consensus and even a mob level of passive acceptance of leadership.
Well, certainly. I think that's across the board in society, you know, starting at the micro level in the military. Critical thinking, for all, you know, they say they want critical thinkers. Like, that's what the papers say. That's what the memos say in the military. The reality is they do not want critical, skeptical thinkers. They do not want independent thought. They want obedient workers, right? That's what they want. They want middle managers. They want company men. And the way you know that is follow the way the military institution and most bureaucratic institutions don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. In terms of positive reinforcement through promotion and elevation and stature. And what you find is that it's the company men, it's the go-along, get-along types, it's the guys who know how to effectively middle manage without questioning, you know, the premise of their boss's ideas or the ideology and mission they're given. And so I think that has seeped into civilian society as we become increasingly militarized, where, you know, we have a culture of distraction that hides behind technology and reality TV, et cetera, as well as apathy that just generates from living paycheck to paycheck and not being able to handle a $400 emergency expense, right, which more than half of Americans deal with. You know, it's very difficult to foster critical thinking. And we also have an education system that's built on test taking and, you know, specifically standardized tests and only focused on math, science, and the most basics of reading rather than, you know, liberal arts and culture and those things that have really been short shrifted. So there's a whole lot of reasons, I think, why critical thinking is not only devalued, but it's increasingly absent in our society. And here's one last thing about that. Some of the people who do the best critical thinking are academics, but they only speak to each other. They don't get out there as public figures. Too often they write books no one reads except other academics, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're critical thinkers. Yeah, they agree with us, right? Go into a university in America today and 90% of the history and political science professors agree with what we're talking about, right, about these forever wars. But they don't even make a splash at all. They don't even write op-eds for their local newspaper, for God's sake, let alone become public activists. And I think that's part of the problem.
So, Danny, once your critical thinking was engaged, how did you cope with meaningless assignments, first in Iraq where you endured Bush's surge, then in Afghanistan where you lived through two surges by Obama? And we can look back now and easily see that neither one of them achieved the stated goals, and that there are even big lies told about the effectiveness of the surge in Iraq.
Well, the short and flippant answer is that while at war, it was chewing tobacco and cigarettes, and then while at home, it was alcohol that made it possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only kidding a little. No, I think it was a real struggle for me. A lot of mental anguish. I felt I was living a double life. There was what I knew to be true in my head because of my study and my experience, and then there was what I had to do day to day, which was run. First, a platoon of about 20 scouts, and then a company or a troop of about 120 scouts, you know, that had to fight a real war. I survived largely by putting my head into the job. I didn't stop reading, I didn't stop thinking, and I didn't stop dissenting once I eventually started writing. But my focus became, how can I do two things? Most importantly, how can I get as many of my kids out of here with all their limbs and their lives? And the second thing was, how can I do that while also respecting the local people whose country this is and treating them with as much dignity and as little harm as possible? So, you know, it became a mission of mine, and it often involved blatant lies and also, you know, equivocation with my bosses. I mean, I would avoid certain missions. I would argue against others. I would phone in certain patrols and only do the bare minimum if I knew that it was futile and that it was going to get somebody killed. You know, it didn't always work. I mean, eight soldiers died under my command, some by suicide. But, you know, I did lose a lot of soldiers directly under my command in combat, plus, you know, dozens wounded. So obviously I wasn't perfect at it, but I like to think, and I think what I thought at the time was, it's better that they have me as the commander because I'll lie a little and I'll put my career on the line and I'll do everything possible to keep them alive because I know, unlike their other commanders, most of whom are true believers or just, you know, sociopaths who want to get promoted, you know, unlike them, I felt, well, I know the war is wrong and I'll try to keep them alive. So that's what I told myself. But here's what would happen. Then I'd get back from the war and I have all this free time. And that's when the frustration would come in, right? And the guilt about what I had done and what I didn't do. And then, you know, I would get like a staff job because in the Army, you go in and out between commanding troops and, you know, making PowerPoint slides at the staff level. So, you know, when I had those jobs, it was a lot harder because pouring myself into a seemingly meaningless, mundane desk job made it a lot harder. Substance abuse, mental health deterioration, moral injury, heightened depression and anxiety as, you know, co-occurring symptoms of PTSD. I mean, I went through all of it. What saved me was the movement, the proverbial movement, right, the anti-war movement, such that it exists. And I started contributing in minor ways at first and then in much greater ways while I was still in uniform, which was unheard of, right, and dangerous, risky, but I did it, and it gave me something to pour myself into. And that really started when I was at grad school. The Army sent me to grad school prior to allowing me to teach history at West Point. And when I had all that free time on my hands and a little distance from the real Army, as we call it, I found the time, the energy, and what I thought was the duty to contribute to the movement. And, you know, everyone does it in different ways. I'm not a great organizer per se, but I'm a pretty good writer and decent speaker. And so I said, I'll use those tools, you know, go a little Marxist, each according to his ability, each according to his needs. And that was my thought.
Danny, I want to go back to something you mentioned a moment ago, and that is that you phoned in some of your patrols. You did the minimum. You took the guys out and you came back, but you cut corners. You didn't do everything you were assigned. And I respect your judgment to keep your troops alive in a lose-lose military situation. But how many other commanders are phoning it in? And to what extent is the entire operation phony? Because everybody knows that the mission is I'm struggling for words to describe a meaningless mission. But, you know, you've been assigned tasks and objectives that are not achievable through military means, yet you must go through the motions on a daily basis.
Absolutely. I think a surprising number of officers are phoning it in to some extent, at this point especially. Less people were doing it in 2006, and slightly more, but still less than today we're doing it in 2011. But if I was, it's just conjecture, of course. Although I do know a lot of people personally, friends of mine who did the same. some of whom are still in the military, so I can't use their names because you could really be fired for some of the shit I pulled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a lot of this going on. Most career officers that I know at this point, even if they don't have my politics, they don't think for a second that there's any victory coming. I mean, they don't, like, they would laugh at you if you were to ask them, you know, oh, what are you guys going to achieve victory in Afghanistan this year? Like, I have friends in Afghanistan that would laugh. I mean, they would say no. I mean, they start treating it like a job, like they're mercenaries. That's what we are to a certain extent, right? No, we just do our job. We do them. We do what the commander says. We make a little progress or we don't, and we try to keep our guys alive, and we come home and we collect a paycheck and we have our socialized military medicine and we move along, and then we treat our PTSD and, you know, struggle with our own addictions and then retire someday. I mean, it's that absurd. I mean, it's a catch-22 novel on a macro scale. There's no mutiny in the military, largely because we're all volunteers rather than draftees, but there is certainly a degree of almost political or military nihilism, you know? It's not for anything anymore, you know? Everyone always says, oh, you know, the great important thing about the military is guys don't fight for their country, they fight for each other. And my thought is, that's true, but that's not enough. I want my soldiers to die for, you know, fight, or if they have to, die for each other, but also in the service of some greater cause like fighting the Nazis. I mean, it should be both, right? And when it becomes just a job, just a routine thing, then war has become a way of life, and empire has become a way of life, and I fear that's been America for quite some time now.
Hmm. So, Danny, we're in the endless war in Afghanistan. There were peace talks underway. I don't have a great deal of confidence in Zalmay Khalilzad, who has now he's serving his third administration in trying to deal with the Afghan scene. I didn't have great confidence in the peace talks themselves because they didn't include the Afghan government, and it was clear that the plan was to try to cram whatever deal was reached by Khalilzad and the Taliban leaders onto the Afghan government. And I felt that was a recipe for almost guaranteed failure. At the same time, for Trump to grandstand and pull the plug on a meeting that was obviously the optics weren't strong. A lot of people criticized that this was happening near the 9/11 anniversary. And although the Taliban didn't have any involvement, even if you believe the official 9/11 story, that was uncomfortable for many Americans who can't tell the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So Trump, I think, bungled the episode. At the same time, I wasn't very confident that it was going to lead to a resolution.
You know, I never thought it was going to lead to anything approaching a comprehensive resolution and the Afghan War. The Afghan War has been going on since 1973 in its latest manifestation, right? That's 46 years, and the United States has really only been at least an on-the-ground part of it for, you know, 18 years, although we were fueling it during the Soviet era of the early to mid-1980s. But
right.
To me, I liked the peace talks, not because I thought they were going to achieve anything, because I thought it was the only near-term way out for the U.S. military.
Yeah.
You know, in 2018, the U.S. military and its Afghan allies killed more civilians than the Taliban for the first time. So I don't think we're a force for good there at all anymore. I also don't think that the U.S. military has or has had in the past or has now any ability to meaningfully alter the outcome in Afghanistan, which is one of two things. Either the country divides along ethnic lines and the government holds on to the north and the Taliban holds on to the south and the east, or the Taliban basically takes over again. Well, I think that's happening regardless of whether we leave in 1 month or one millennia. And I bet I'm right. And I'd put money on it. And I think predictions are a tricky thing, but I'm very confident in this one. So my thought was, you know, the talks were flawed. They were never really going to achieve much. I just hoped it achieved getting the United States out. And I had this feeling that maybe if only Nixon could go to China, then perhaps only Trump could go to Kabul. That was foolish, ultimately, because I didn't count on the laziness, the immorality, and the, you know, complete intellectual vacuousness of Trump, right? He's so erratic, as you can't count on him to be Nixon, you know. Not that Nixon was a good guy, but Trump is far less, you know, engaged in foreign policy than or knowledgeable than Nixon. So,
yeah.
You know, I think it was a big problem. It'd be great if we can get something more comprehensive with the Afghan government involved. I don't think the Taliban has any incentive to do that, though. They're winning by every measure, right? By every measure, the Taliban is winning.
Well, and we can also state objectively that the U.S. continues to lose by being drawn into these incidents where we're told the Afghans call for air cover and we blow up a wedding. And there have been three weddings in 3 weeks where 40 civilians have been killed. And that doesn't even include the pine nut pickers who, were resting around a fire when we launched missiles that killed a couple of dozen of them. And so we're not only not winning, but we're making things worse.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what those people, those poor people in the wedding and in the pine nut pickers were? They were guilty of one thing, or two things. They were guilty of being Afghan in Afghanistan and of gathering in numbers higher than, two or three.
Yeah.
That's a crime. From the airframe of a U.S. Air Force or a U.S. Navy bomber, you can be guilty, or from a Predator drone, you can be guilty and sentenced to death without any due process simply for being a Afghan who gathers with other people in one place, because the assumption of guilt is there. Now, I'm not saying we always bomb groups of Afghans, but over and over and over, and like I said, we killed more civilians last year than the Taliban. Come on, guys. What are we doing? And the bipartisan media and congressional establishment, they all want to stay. Everybody from Rachel Maddow to Tucker Carlson, or maybe not him, but, Sean Hannity, they want to stay. And it blows my mind.
Recently, I talked to a soldier who just returned from a deployment in intelligence in Afghanistan. And one of the things that I learned from this person is that the drone strike calls are now being made in theater, and there is no oversight from Washington. Now, I criticized Obama for being personally involved in the decision-making of the Tuesday kill conference back during his administration, but I'm even less comfortable with the way that Trump has allowed commanders in the field to operate at will, and there doesn't appear to be any remote control on their activities.
Absolutely. I mean, some sort of middle ground between picking targets like Lyndon Johnson did, and Terror Tuesdays like Obama did, and then what we have under Trump, which is the evolution of the responsibility down to the generals or lower. Look, generals like stats because generals like numbers, and they don't like critical thinking. They like measurable, outputs that they can point to as success. We've seen this since the body counts in Vietnam. And, they're going to do two things. One of them is understandable, one of them isn't. The understandable thing is, in order to protect their troops, or what they think is protecting their troops, they'll bomb the shit out of anything, right? Just keep the enemy away, pound them from the air so troops aren't in danger. The second thing they'll do is they'll try to create measurable stats. Number of Taliban killed, number of bombs dropped, inputs rather than outputs that they count. Right, what we call measures of performance rather than measures of effectiveness within the military. So, this is a big problem that we've put the responsibility for drone strikes that low, and it's no accident that we've seen not only more bombs dropped under the Trump years than any other year, but also more civilian casualties than any other year. There's a direct relation, and we're making strategic errors in the name of tactical necessity, or not even necessity, but tactical practicality. And that's the recipe for forever war and continued failure.
And Danny, when we zoom out a little bit just and talk about drones, it was Bush who first started to use them, and he did it somewhat sparingly, especially compared to Obama. And then Obama took advantage of the technological leap that the U.S. appears to have on the rest of the militarized world. But we're seeing that that advantage has evaporated. The Iranians shot down one of our drones back in May, and in the dramatic attack on the Saudi Aramco facilities just a few weeks ago, the Houthis claim responsibility for a combination drone and cruise missile assault that certainly embarrassed the Saudis and the United States, not only for the failure of the Patriot missiles, but just the lack of military readiness of the Saudis in general. And now we are expected to save their bacon. We'll talk about that part in a moment. But I'd just like your comment on drones in particular, and that the U.S. has lost the advantage that we once had.
You know, I warned years ago in writing and on a number of podcasts and radio spots that America would someday rue the day that we set the precedent of utilizing our drones as assassination tools over sovereign territory without the permission, in many cases, of the host country. Because now that we've set that precedent, that you can fly your drones over any airspace and murder people from the sky, right, without due process in the U.S. Justice Department or without international backing, right, or international sanction, I said, well, wait till the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Houthis, you name it, start doing the same thing. Because we're going to scream bloody murder, but their point is going to be really correct, which is you've been doing it for decades before we ever got involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, you know, we started this. We set the precedent. Instead of going, it's like the same thing with nuclear weapons. Instead of going to the, you know, international bodies, whatever legitimacy you think they have, and saying, look, we need to come up with some sort of international stricture, some sort of international precedent or spirit of the law on how we're going to use these new technological devices. That's the first thing. The second thing is the mismatch you're talking about. There is a mismatch in military technology right now, and this happens occasionally. It happened with the machine gun in World War I, right? You know, the machine gun was too powerful that it made the defensive just the primary effective tactic for a long, long time, right? Until really the radio and tanks were operated together in the Blitzkrieg of the Second World War. These military mismatches occur occasionally, and when they happen, they're usually really bloody. Well, the mismatch today is that offensive cruise missile technology, right, has outstretched defensive Patriot missile type missile defense. And so what that means is the attack on the Saudi facilities, the oil facilities, is not going to be the last we'll see. The vulnerability was put on stark display for the world. But if we attempt some sort of war with Iran in the Persian Gulf or with China in the Straits of Taiwan, mark my words, U.S. ships are going to the bottom of the sea with hundreds of sailors. Now, we may win in the end, but do you think the United States of America, look, we're okay. You know, the height of the Iraq War, the American people basically dealt with 100 soldiers killed a month. But you think the American people are ready for 400 sailors to drown and burn to death in a day? I'm not so sure, but I think that that mismatch is going to be in existence for quite some time.
And the miscalculation of the United States, at least as it's evidenced in the corporate media and their assessments, you know, the New York Times, twice in a four-day period, ran front-page stories that basically are attempting to use a parade of John Boltons to shame Trump into an attack on Iran and to make him appear weak because he has shown restraint. Now, I got a lot of problems with Trump, but I am relieved that he has not yet tried a military attack on Iran, since we have no proof that it was Iran directly responsible for the attack on the Saudi oil facilities. And at the United Nations this week, I was sorry to see Germany, France, and Britain fall in line and accept the U.S. blame game without the investigation that the Saudis themselves have called for. And so we are now papering over any need for evidence and just claiming as fact that Iran did this. And I am appalled by the yellow journalism of the Times to run these deeply biased articles where they make no effort to provide context about what would happen if we attack Iran, as you just did a moment ago, Danny, and they just work on the optics and use it as another way to pummel Trump.
Oh, yeah, reflexive anti-Trumpism has turned, well, it was already the case, but it's made it worse. It's turned both political parties into, you know, militarist warmongering parties. I mean, everyone's a neocon now, right? These discredited neocons, they're on MSNBC now, right? David Frum and You'll see Crystal on there and all these generals, right? It's ridiculous.
Max Boot, come on.
Max Boot, I mean, one of the most ludicrous figures.
Yeah.
I've read all his books. I mean, they're ridiculous. I mean, this is an actual guy who has called for American Empire and actually used the word, which is rare. These guys are all being recycled on MSNBC, New York Times. But look, here's the thing. I mean, the writers at the Times, the publishers at the Times, it's not their kids in the U.S. Navy that are going to the bottom of the sea. It hasn't been their kids serving in the U.S. Navy or the U.S. Army since at least the 1950s and 60s, maybe since World War II. The last time the Sulzbergers ever, you know, sent one of their scions of the Times to war. Times have changed. It's poor kids. It's rural kids. It's people who don't live in the suburbs of Chicago and L.A. That's who's going on the bottom of the sea. They're the people that serve with me. You know, they're the kids from Stewart's Draft, Virginia, the warehouse capital of the world. That's where they're from. You've never been there, right? Not you, but the collective us.
Me too. I haven't been there.
You know, I mean, but my point is, you know, I get angry about this. I mean, I take this very seriously. When you become a war cheerleader, as a journalist, as a politician, as any public figure, you know, the results and the blood, they're partly on your hands. You know, be very careful, I would warn people. Be very careful to cheerlead for war. Be very cautious about that. But we're not cautious. And we're in a crazy situation where Donald Trump, the playboy real estate magnate, reality TV star, Donald Trump is showing more restraint on Iran than the liberal mainstream media.
Yeah.
How in the world did we? We're through the looking glass, Alice. Right.
Yeah. No, it is truly stunning, and we also see the so-called progressives, and you know, I generally admire and support Bernie Sanders, but in the last debate on ABC, he was the only one asked to comment on Venezuela. And Jorge Ramos cornered him, essentially, and tried to get him to call Maduro a dictator. He settled for tyrant, but he didn't articulate any of the more thoughtful policy positions that he's taken about Venezuela, because under the spotlight and, you know, with all these other candidates who support Trump in terms of regime change in Venezuela, Bernie was trying not to, again, be the commie socialist defender of, people who've been denounced by the U.S. in Central and South America.
Well, absolutely right. I mean, once you're on a national stage, I mean, Bernie's been right about a lot of issues, especially in Central and South America, for a long time. I mean, in the 1980s, he was sometimes a lone voice, right, calling, you know, being willing to say positive things about Cuba along with the negative things, et cetera. It's disappointing to see. He's still ahead of most of the other contenders on these issues. I mean, I think he's preferable. I'm appalled that they barely talk about foreign policy at all in the debates. I mean, in the first set of debates, which was 4 hours, right, 20 candidates, 4 hours, I counted, right? I went through the transcripts, and there was like seven references to Afghanistan, and Tulsi Gabbard made five of them, you know?
Yeah.
How is it the case that America's longest war barely gets mentioned? How is it the case that the fact that America has 800 bases in 80 countries and is bombing seven countries every single day? I mean, how is that not a major issue? Especially when it's the president who, you know, presidents don't control health care policy. Congress does. They only have so much influence. But on foreign policy, this isn't a good thing, by the way, they have unilateral, almost dictatorial power. We don't declare war anymore. Presidents move us around like toy soldiers, which is what we are. And so that's the thing they should be talking. 80% of the debate should be about that.
Well, and this,
that's the thing presidents do.
This is another example of media malpractice, in my view, Danny, because the way these debates are framed, they spend inordinate amounts of time comparing minutiae in their health care plans, which, of course, have to get through Congress anyway. So it's all just, you know, these are blueprints, right? And my blueprint's better than your blueprint. But when it comes to the real issues of where do these candidates stand, you know, what is Pete Buttigieg's view of the use of the military in regime change wars? I really need to hear that. And Tulsi Gabbard, who I have some issues with, you know, I'm not completely sold on her, but she is the only one who speaks out votes explicitly against regime change wars, and fortunately she will be on the debate stage at the next outing in October. But, you know, if she isn't called on, if the question isn't authorized to talk about these things, then you've got to kind of jam it in. And the way the networks conduct these sports center style wrestling matches, and you know, it's all the leader in the polls is at the center of the stage, and you know that that person gets the most time, and you see the fringe candidates over there after every comment waving, saying, "Look at me, look at me, look at me," and it's grotesque the way these so-called debates are conducted. And they don't address the true concerns they should.
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous. It's entertainment-based. It's style over substance. Agree fully. And, that, you know, that guarantees that real issues won't be talked about in terms of foreign policy especially. And Tulsi Gabbard is imperfect, but to her credit, she's really the only one who's made foreign policy and ending endless war the core of her campaign, you know. And so whether she wins or loses, whether she's the perfect candidate or not, I think she's extraordinarily valuable. But you're right, she'll be out on the fringes, and maybe she'll get a few minutes to talk, and, you know, who knows if they'll even give her the platform to talk about what she really knows, which is foreign policy, or at least aspects of it. So yeah, this is all very disturbing. It's part of a disease. That's why my latest article that's forthcoming is called Impeach the System, Not Trump. Or maybe impeach both would be better, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. Danny, let's talk next about the departure of John Bolton. You wrote a column about that. And, you know, on the day that his ouster was announced, I said, well, you know, we can celebrate this for a minute. He did come from the very bottom of the barrel of right-wing sociopaths, but the barrel isn't empty. And so we always have to shudder at the prospect that someone worse can be found. So first of all, comment on his departure. And I can't even remember the name of the guy they've plugged in as the new national security advisor, but I've heard him described as someone who has been mentored by Bolton and is very similar in views without the bombast.
You know, I wrote a living obituary for John Bolton recently, which I thought was clever, and I was just, sometimes I get so angry that I have to be sarcastic to make light of it. Look, Bolton was a disaster. I mean, he never met a regime he didn't want to change. He's a true hawk's hawk. He's neocon gold standard. But, you know, the reality is his replacement is not going to be all that different. We're recycling all the should-have-been discredited neocons. I'm always afraid of what comes next. It's like when we decapitate terrorist networks, right, of their leaders, what tends to happen is a more extreme, more radicalized, younger version pops up, right? And we have to cut that head off and repeat the cycle. I think the same happens with Trump's advisors. You know, it seems to get worse and worse every day. Bolton may be gone, but the age of Bolton we're still living in, the age where reflexive regime change and undeclared by Congress wars and military interventions unilaterally forced by the executive branch. Like, those things have become normal. They've become commonplace. So yeah, Bolton will be fine. He makes millions of dollars a year on Fox News. You know, he'll shuffle through the corridors of whatever neocon think tanks will have him. He'll collect his money and he'll get on TV just plenty. But we live in the age of Bolton. And we've lived in the age of Bolton since George W. Bush. And I'll tell you, Obama did very little to change that, and I'm not so certain the next president will either.
Yeah. And I also want to mention that we had this momentary feeling that the era of Benjamin Netanyahu was behind us. It was in the rearview mirror. And this week, after the horse trading over coalitions in the Knesset, Netanyahu came up with one extra vote, one extra member, compared to the Benny Gantz blue and white party. And this means that he has a new opportunity to form a government. He gets a month, and then I guess he can ask for an extra 2 weeks before they would then give Gantz an opportunity to form a government if Netanyahu fails. But this is discouraging that the Israelis are so divided, and that his tactics, which are as low as Trump's, calls for racist mentality, the fear mongering over the vote by Arab citizens of Israel, and the outlandish promises that Netanyahu was making during the final days, annexing virtually the entire West Bank. And also, we know that he is running from the law. He needs to remain prime minister to maintain his immunity from fraud prosecution. So it's a messy situation. But the bottom line is, it appears that Netanyahu will fight on and might end up being prime minister again.
Oh, yeah, Bibi's not going anywhere. If America lives in the age of Bolt and the world lives in the age of Bibi, and he's in a pod, really, is the only way to describe he and Trump. I mean, they're made for each other, right? They're both, like, running from the law and corruption charges, and, you know, they both make fantastical promises. They both play like populists. Of course, the interesting thing is that, you know, Netanyahu runs as some sort of outsider. Meanwhile, he's the consummate insider. He was the youngest prime minister in, right, Israeli history. He's been in and out of government and opposition, I mean, forever. I mean, the guy is just the ultimate insider, but he's got, like, half the Israeli electorate convinced he's the ultimate outsider. He's doing the same sort of thing that Trump does. I mean, he's like, he's Hillary Clinton, but using Trumpian language. Mm. It's like the worst of all worlds. He's a monster, for lack of a better term. He is making it so that there can be no two-state solution. He's basically destroyed the two-state solution. And the obituary should say killed by Netanyahu in Israel, not killed by the Palestinians. And that's a provocative term that's going to get me in trouble and always does. I don't care. It's just true, right? I mean, there's some shared responsibility in all things, but if you have to put your finger on it, the two-state solution and therefore largely any future stability in the Middle East, at least partially, the tombstone should read Bibi Netanyahu and the right-wing domination of Israel, because that's what's responsible for it ultimately. And Trump's going to cheerlead for him and enable him along the way, just like other presidents have. The only difference is, and it's almost refreshing in a macabre way, Trump at least says it, you know? He just comes out and says, yep, I'm on Israel's team, annex the West Bank, annex the Golan Heights, I don't care. I like it. Do what you got to do. Name a settlement after me. You know, he's staggeringly honest, and if it wasn't so dark, it would almost be refreshing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Danny, as we wrap up, I want to return to the personal side for a moment, because in the article that we were talking about in the early part of the interview, you talk honestly about your struggles with PTSD, and some are current. You reference some treatment here in 2019. To the extent you wish to, can you talk about how you struggle with that? And how many other soldiers who have been to Iraq and Afghanistan do you feel are fighting with the same internal issues?
Everyone I know, just about everyone that I went to the academy with, just about everyone that served under my command is either diagnosed or undiagnosed with PTSD, meaning they have it, whether or not they seek treatment. We know it's several hundred thousand that are in treatment, and then most expert estimates put the number at double that, right? Because a lot of people white knuckle it, or, you know, think it makes them weak to get treatment, although that culture is changing. PTSD is different things for different people. It's more than just reactions to loud sounds and bad dreams, although I certainly am affected by both of those. It's about co-occurring symptoms of depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation and, you know, sometimes even OCD-type behaviors. I mean, it's an epidemic. It's a true injury. Combine it with what they're starting to call moral injury, right, which is the sense that you did things that were, you know, abhorrent to your, you know, soul or to your sense of yourself as a human being. I think what contributes to some of the PTSD is not just advances in psychology that have put their finger on what these things are, because they've always existed, but also the sense that when you fight in feudal wars, when you're not able to put your finger on what you did it all for, sacrificing and the killing, I think it makes it that much harder to reintegrate into society. I think it makes it that much harder to close the book or get some closure on your time in the military. And look, it's the guys that I served with weren't a bunch of whiners. I mean, I'm talking everything from Green Berets to guys with medals for valor. I'm telling you that just about everybody I served with, I mean, just I'll speak specifically for my closest friends from West Point, we're talking dozens of people. I don't know anybody who's not suffering on some level. For me, I'm in a decent place right now, but it has its ups and downs. It's not linear, and it's a continued struggle. I'm in treatment. People have it worse than me. And I'm fighting my individual battle. But, like, you know, I'll close with this. Like I said, I'm thankful for the movement, for my writing and my contribution, however small it is, because it gives me purpose every day and gives me identity to a certain extent that I lost when I stopped being a soldier, because I've been a soldier for 18 years. And there was a moment where I thought, if I'm not a soldier anymore, what am I? You know, I didn't want to be a soldier anymore, but it was still a shock to the system not to be. So, you know, that's... Thank God for the movement, and you know, I encourage other people, if it's right for you, other veterans, you know, speak out, use your talents.
Well, Danny, your writing and other expression, you know, including talking with me, to the extent that it's therapy, I'm very happy to support it. I also think that it's a valuable contribution, notwithstanding your suffering from the service that you gave. And my concern is, you know, I'm a little older than you, and I have seen so many veterans of the Vietnam War end up living on the streets because of primarily untreated PTSD. And I hope that we do not repeat the errors of that previous generation. I do feel like the VA is attempting to address these issues, but I feel like it's inadequate.
I agree, and I hope we do avoid it, because there are some worrying signs that we are repeating some of these things, and some of those signs are the number of homeless veterans is increasing again among Iraq and Afghan vets, and then also the 22 suicides a day among all veterans, including older veterans. But you know, I mean, we need to keep raising the issue, and I'm just thankful to have this platform to do it, and I thank you for having me on.
Danny Surgeon, always a pleasure. We'll talk again. Thanks for listening to this powerful interview with Danny Surgeon. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.